Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. Today on the program is Jen Chaplin, author of My Autobiography of Carson McCullers. Jen, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start out by congratulating you, not only on writing such a wonderful book, but I've seen the book on a lot of year-end best of lists and that sort of thing. So congratulations. It seems like it's really finding an audience.
Yeah, I hope so. It's been such a strange year to publish a book in 2020. Mm-hmm. So it is nice to see it kind of getting some love on the lists this time of year, for sure.
Now, I'm not sure if this is a delicate question to ask or not, but were you surprised at that at all? I mean, Carson McCullers isn't the most well-known writer in the world, though she definitely has her fans, myself among them.
You know, I am surprised in part. I mean, this is my first book, and I think of it as sort of an experimental memoir biography. About an author that, as you said, not that many people are familiar with. You know, there are definitely writers who know McCullers' work, academics who've studied her in depth. But just, you know, when you encounter people day to day, if I mention the name of my book, most of the time they don't know who Carson McCullers is. So yeah, it's been super exciting to me to see the book circulate in the world and find its audience among people of kind of differing age groups and different backgrounds. I think I was most surprised that it was shortlisted for the National Book Award. That seemed like a very sort of like mainstream prize for it to be up for. And that was kind of like a huge surprise to me. But of course, really exciting too. And I hope what it means is that more people out there are finding McCullers' work.
No, I mean, so it's interesting that you say that not many people who you talk to about the book have heard of Carson McCullers or can identify her works, because she was quite well known in her time. I mean, Tennessee Williams compared her favorably to Faulkner. Richard Wright said she wrote better black characters than any other white writer. I mean, it's not like she was obscure in her time, but you feel like, I mean, is it just as simple as she was a woman writer and women writers aren't as well remembered as male writers?
I think that was certainly part of it. She died fairly young, so her output wasn't huge. But then I think maybe the biggest reason has to do with how difficult it was for kind of the literary establishment to claim her as a Southern writer, and for the South and for Georgia to claim her that way. So other writers like Flannery O'Connor, for example, are anthologized and taught and kind of beloved still to this day and much more well-known, because I think that it was easier for Flannery O'Connor's work and her life to be sort of absorbed into that establishment. Carson's life, as I write about, is the life of a queer person kind of seeking her community and kind of leaving the South behind for a very different life and lifestyle. And her work deals with themes that are, while super relevant today, a little bit more dicey politically, let's say, than some of what other Southern writers in her sort of generation, specifically other women Southern writers, were addressing. The way that she writes specifically about race relations in the South, and the way that she writes about queer desire and queer relationships, Some of that, you know, could come across as radical even today. All of it to me seems really relevant. And so I think that some of what she was writing about kind of, you know, mixed race relationships and queer relationships, I think that a lot of that just kind of put her out of the running for being sort of totally embraced by critics and writers as a Southern writer. So she's, yeah, but she is beloved in her time. I don't know. I think, sorry, this is a bit of a long answer, but I think some of what I write about in terms of lesbian erasure and invisibility, in terms of the way Carson's own sexuality was erased after her death, I think some of that has to do with it too. It's like she lived a certain way and was a part of a certain community during her lifetime. And then after the fact, all of that sort of was shut down and her legacy shifted, or there was an attempt to shift her legacy into something a little bit more palatable or easy to absorb by some perceived literary public. So I don't know. I think all of those things work together to sort of erase her a bit.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about your book is I feel like, you know, when McCullers is remembered, she's often remembered as sort of like a tragic case, you know, as somebody who lived this very difficult life and had, you know, was married twice to this horrible man and had problems with alcohol and had problems with her health. And, you know, her life definitely seems sad if you forget the fact that she was a lesbian and like had happy relationships with women, you know, especially towards the end of her life with Mary Mercer, who we'll talk about, I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later. But I mean, is that kind of one of the reasons you wanted to write this book, is to sort of say, no, her life wasn't all tragic. It's just only tragic if you look at the straight parts of her life.
I think so. Yeah. I think that the sort of like joy of her spirit and her approach to her life, despite all of the tragedy that she experienced, is something that's really amazing, but that is not captured very well in the sort of capsule biography of her. Or if you just kind of read through quickly the facts of her life and what happened, you might get the idea that she was just sort of a miserable person. But that so is not the way it plays out when you read interviews with people who knew her, when you read anything about her, when you read her her letters in particular. You really see this person who was so vibrant. She was hilarious. She was really funny. And that really comes through in her fiction as well. Mm-hmm. And so you lose a huge part of her personality if you tell her life story that way. And that also kind of doesn't really square with the fiction itself, or with any of her writing, which again has, you know, while it deals with darker themes, is really vibrant and funny and joyous at times as well. So I think there's just a much more complicated picture that emerges of her when you look a little bit more closely.
And even the idea of her as a Southern writer, I mean, she definitely doesn't seem in obvious ways to fit into the tradition that sort of goes from, you know, the agrarians to Faulkner to O'Connor. But she does fit into a sort of queer Southern tradition that, I mean, it mostly her contemporaries, Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams. Mm-hmm. So is that kind of, I noticed that as a sort of thread in your book as well, not just looking at her queer life, but looking at her as a member of these various queer communities.
Yeah, well, she definitely was really close friends with Tennessee Williams, and they wrote together and worked together. And Capote, she kind of helped launch his career by introducing him to his editor or agent, I can't remember. But then ultimately they parted ways and really grew to despise each other. But there's definitely a way, when you kind of look back at those communities, that the Southern queer writers kind of were, if not on the same team, they were all sort of in conversation with one another. And then there's a much different version of the Southern writer that was the straight Southern writer. And those groups clashed. I mean, at Yaddo, I write about this, there was this kind of big ordeal that happened involving Robert Lowell. But Flannery O'Connor was one of the people who was kind of trying to bring down the director of Yaddo, the writer's residency, for her queer identity during the Red Scare, during the Lavender Scare. And it was a number of queer Southern writers who kind of came out of the woodwork to speak on her behalf. So I think there's kind of a lot of undertones of sort of homophobia that work against those mm-hmm. writers, but then there's a lot of community that works in their favor during their lifetimes, especially.
Yeah. I love Flannery O'Connor, but she really had terrible political views.
She really did. More of that comes out as time goes on. There was an article about her letters and journals and her mm-hmm. use of the N-word, and it's not good.
I remember there's a quote where she's talking about the Freedom Riders, and she says, "It seems like a hell of a long way to go to get shot." And it's that's awful.
No,
that's really bad. And that's one of the things. I mean, you know, I guess this maybe seems like kind of an obvious question, but do you feel like McCullough's queerness is related to the fact that, you know, from my perspective as a 21st century leftist, she has pretty good politics and, you know, writes very favorably about characters who are influenced by Marxism in her first book and mm-hmm. Refuses to give her papers to the Columbus, Georgia library because they're segregated. I mean, do you feel like that's related to the fact that she was queer?
I think yes and no. So I mean,
Truman Capote had terrible politics too. So
right. You can definitely be queer and not have a progressive political view and not take the actions that she took in her life, right? Like with the public library, I think that's such a good example of kind of who she was, where she just, like, even if someone, you know, wanted to honor her, she didn't want that honor if she didn't agree with the way that they understood equality. And that totally shines through her work. But I think that the queerness intersects with her politics because of who she surrounded herself with, who she befriended, and what their politics were. At the same time, it was her husband, Reeves, who kind of first introduced her to Marxism and to these different political ideas than what she actually had access to growing up in Columbus. So, you know, it's funny, though. Their marriage is kind of a marriage of two queer people. And so there's a way in which her relationship with Reeves also opens her life to certain other kind of queer characters, especially kind of these groups of gay men that she didn't have access to prior to meeting him. But I think it was kind of their relationship that first opened her eyes to what she had recognized as the inequalities of growing up in the South, the racism of Columbus. And then I would say that it wasn't really until later in her life that she understood her own queerness and maybe understood that as a political perspective. I don't know how integrated those ideas were for her. But I do think when you look at her writing, it's hard not to see the overlap, that the characters she writes about who often express or experience queer desire also have these maybe more Marxist political views, or they have these ideas about equality, about relationships. I mean, I think her last book, Clock Without Hands, does a great job of really showcasing that overlap.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about Clock Without Hands. In the book, you write that you've never met anybody who's read Clock Without Hands who you didn't tell to read Clock Without Hands. Well, Jen, I've read Clock Without Hands.
That's so wonderful. I'm so glad to hear it.
I've read almost all of her books. There's a few I haven't gotten to yet, but I have read that one. For me, one of the things that's really exceptional about that book is that in her earlier work, it seems like she's really focused on these sort of Southern outcast characters. But in that book, she's very empathetic towards characters who are kind of on the inside, the sort of, fire-breathing reactionaries, but also the kind of the cowards who make bigotry acceptable by not opposing it. That seems like a really impressive accomplishment, a moral accomplishment as well as an artistic accomplishment. What do you love about that book?
Well, one of the things I love is that I was reading it for the first time kind of in the run-up to the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like it could have been written now. It's written in the 60s, but it feels like it just has so many different overlaps with issues in our own time. And so I think what you point out about how she writes specifically about not just the like ultra-conservative character of the judge in that book. But she also writes about those who allow violence to take place by just kind of turning a blind eye, right? I feel like we saw so much of that, and we continue to see so much of that in the U.S. today, even around, let's say, like the George Floyd protests, the way that people have responded to those. I think she's writing about a lot of the psychodynamics that allow white supremacy and racism to continue to exist and to continue to kind of like grow and foster new members and and things like that. And so I just really admire her ability to access that those dynamics and put them on the page in a way that is both funny and kind of heartbreaking. And then the other thing I really love is again, her sense of humor. I think the judge is a really funny character. And so she's both taking him and his kind of psychological struggles like really seriously, but she's also making fun of him. And I just love that combination of things. I think that by bringing those two forces to bear on one character, we have a different kind of empathy for him at the same time that we don't have to like side with him or agree with him. And I think that's so powerful.
So we've talked a bit about Carson McCullers, who is, you know, a lot of the content of your book is about her, but a lot of your book is also about you and kind of your experience of getting to know Carson McCullers through her work and through her letters and even through her therapy transcripts.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit of the story of how you became interested in Carson McCullers?
Sure. Yeah. So I was working as an intern at an archive in Austin, Texas, at the Harry Ransom Center, which is an archive that houses the papers and manuscripts and books, but also the belongings and objects of a bunch of major writers and artists. I was working there while I was a graduate student at UT studying English. And I had never read Carson McCullers, but I came across these letters that were written to her by a woman named Anne Marie Schwarzenbach. And I came across them just because a scholar had asked about these letters. And I started reading them and was just totally shocked to learn that they were love letters. And they documented a relationship between Carson and Anne Marie that seemed really passionate and interesting and significant. And so then I kind of, as I often did in that job in the archive, when I would come across something that seemed juicy, I kind of, you know, ran it down and tried to figure out, you know, what else can I learn about these two women and their relationship? And as I started Googling, I just didn't like the way the relationship was being characterized. It was either talked about as like a friendship, or it was talked about as this obsession. I think if you even look on Carson's Wikipedia page now, you'll see like her obsession with Anne Marie Schwarzenbach or something. And that just didn't seem to be borne out by these letters from Anne Marie. It seemed like there was a lot more there. So I just started digging and reading the biographies, reading all of Carson's fiction, just trying to understand who she was, and continued to be frustrated with the parts of the story that seem to be either left out or sort of written about with these, with this language that was very sort of whitewashed, or that really took out some of the details that I was able to glean just from looking at those letters. And so in the process of becoming interested in her, I ended up cataloging her personal effects at the Harry Ransom Center, along with the personal effects of a few other figures like Gertrude Stein, Alice B. Toklas, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So kind of a weird assortment of folks. And I was cataloging their clothes, their socks, their pajamas, their coats, their lighters, their typewriters, all kinds of different personal effects. And so as I kind of got to know those objects, I just got sucked in deeper and eventually ended up staying in Carson's house in Columbus. And the book kind of follows that research trajectory, how I got interested in Carson, and then kind of how I followed her from there on.
Did that process, and I'm trying to think of a way to phrase this question, but did the process of getting to know her so closely and so intimately through her house, through her clothes, did that ever feel sort of creepy to you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I thought just...
I'm glad you said that, because you could have very easily been understandably offended by that question.
No, not at all offended. I mean, working at the Ransom Center in particular and being like, you're in, and I've written about this. I wrote, my very first essay was about working there. It's called Finders Keepers, and it's kind of about theft in the archive. But working there, you're in this space that's like both this sort of like fun house of other people's stuff and ideas and materials, but also this weird tomb, this weird mausoleum of all these, you know, dead people's belongings, especially the personal effects. There's something super creepy about them. And at the same time, super intimate and sort of fascinating. The same was true for Carson's house, where, like, as I write about, I didn't even know where I was allowed to sit because most of the furniture in the house belonged to her at some time. And so, you know, in my archival training, I would think like, okay, we must handle these objects with gloves. And at the same time, I was living in the house, and it's a writing residency, and lots of people have lived there. So it was always super unclear, like, how do I relate to these belongings? And, you know, at the same time too, there's something about old things. There's something about someone's, you know, former stuff. It's like being in kind of a dead grandparent's house or something to a certain extent, like that everything's a little bit old and out of date. And sure, that's definitely creepy. No doubt.
Yeah. Now, so did you feel like spending that time with that personal material helped you understand her work better?
I do, to a certain extent. Yeah, I feel like I was able to understand her writing process a bit better by, you know, getting to know her clothes. So, for example, the nightgowns that were in the Ransom Center, and then all these coats, how she often was writing from bed. And that's sort of why the nightgowns ended up in the archive, or at least that's sort of my theory. I got to know, a little bit more about her writing process, and then I got to visualize the time period in her life a little bit better by seeing what it was that she wore. And certainly the clothes were also an avenue to understanding her queerness and how she presented herself and how she, you know, kind of wanted to look out in the world. I think fashion kind of really gives us a way in to understanding kind of how a person thinks about their gender and their sexuality in the time. And there's not that many things that give us access to that information. So clothes was definitely, you know, one way in.
Yeah. How would you describe how she dressed?
Well, it's funny. My paperback is coming out in January, and the publisher has decided to put Carson's face on the cover. And they are using an illustration that they found of a photograph that was taken by, I'm just blanking on her name. Her name's Louise, by a photographer when Carson was pretty young, in her 20s. And these photographs of her are some of the most like feminine photos that I've ever seen of Carson. Mm-hmm. and of course, like that's the kind of young feminine Carson is the one the publisher chose to kind of like lure readers in, I guess. And so when she was younger, she kind of went back and forth between sort of wearing dresses and these like little tweedy skirt suits, especially when she was first in New York. And this much more masculine and severe way of dressing, some of which seems like it was inspired by her encounters with people like Anne-Marie Schwarzenbach and Erika Mann, Thomas Mann's daughter, who was kind of a power lesbian in New York at the time. And so her style kind of slowly evolved. And so there was a time when she was in New York, in and out of New York, when she's wearing kind of these white shirts with really big cuffs and collars over blazers. And it's a very like almost hammed up masculine style. There's a really great Harper's Bazaar photo spread of her and Tennessee Williams. And the article is called Incessant Prize Winners. And they're, you know, on facing pages, and she's smoking, you know, a cigarette, and they're basically wearing the same outfit. And mm-hmm. like, clearly that's part of the joke, you know, that's part of the joy of it. And then later in her life, she kind of shifts again, and she's just wearing like these tapestried vests and these coats, the coats that I cataloged that are a bit over the top. So she had like a number of different looks throughout her life.
You mentioned a couple names in that answer, and I'd love to talk about Anne-Marie Schwarzenbach. You quote your partner in the book of saying, God, she's such a type about Anne-Marie, which I thought was great. What type would you call Anne-Marie?
Oh, she is totally that person that woman who, you think when you're with her that she's totally in love with you and that, you know, everything's going great. But then like within seconds, she can be completely cold as ice. That seems to be Anne-Marie's way. She was constantly making women fall in love with her, or that's sort of the way it's narrativized by a variety of people who were there at the time and kind of, you know, doting on different women and then kind of using their affection as a way to just showcase her own power to a certain extent by kind of pulling that affection away or giving it back. And that is such a type. That's a type in relationships among, I feel like, young people especially. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it certainly is a lesbian type. You see it in movies and TV shows when you do get a lesbian character. There are a lot of Anne Marie's out there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt so bad for Carson when you were just narrating those interactions that she had with her. It seems so painful.
For sure. So painful, but so common, you know, so normal and so typical, I think, of relationships among women, of especially like young relationships. It's just so easy to get into a situation like that, for sure.
You also mentioned Tennessee Williams, and I love Tennessee Williams. He's one of my favorite writers, and he comes off really well in your book, which I was glad to read. and he's one of the few people that Carson McCullers describes her illnesses to in detail, which to me seems like a really remarkable display of trust. Could you describe their relationship and what it meant to her, sort of both personally and artistically?
Yeah, I mean, they were ultimately really close, and they wrote a lot of letters back and forth. But the story of their meeting is kind of like one of the best little anecdotes, I think, that kind of signifies their friendship to a certain extent, which is that Tennessee reached out to Carson after her first book came out and just said, you know, this book is amazing and I want to know you. And she showed up at his house in Nantucket. It basically just stayed there for the summer and would often return there in the summers. And they would sit across from each other at the table and just write all day. They would workshop Tennessee's plays. They would read aloud from what Carson was working on. And he kind of helped her as she turned her several of her novels into plays, adapted them for the stage. And she ultimately had a lot of success with that. So I think that their relationship was really fruitful for her work. And I assume for his as well. I don't think I kind of spent as much time thinking about how Carson may have impacted Tennessee's work. But I bet if you go back from the date of their meeting, you can probably see the influence of that kind of creative friendship. And then, of course, they also were able to be open with each other about their relationships, about being queer. And that sort of opened a number of doors to Carson as well. Tennessee helped her find her agent at a point when she needed to replace her agent. So there was also just a degree of sort of professional networking happening that was important between the two of them. But yeah, she trusted Tennessee. She could tell him what she was experiencing with her illness, what was really going on with Reeves, which not a lot of people knew at the time. And of course, you know, she always went to Tennessee when she was pining over someone, often Anne-Marie at the early stages, but later in her life, different women came and went, and she often talked about them to Tennessee. So yeah, they were totally confidants and very close friends.
And did she meet Tennessee after she had lived at February House, or is that before? What was the timeline of that?
That's a good question. I want to say it's around the same time. It's possible that she went out to Nantucket before she ended up at February House. I'd have to look back at that.
And for our listeners who don't know about February House, I feel like this is, you know, I read a book about the literary history of Brooklyn, and I was so excited to go visit February House and see it for myself. And then I found out it was demolished to make room for the BQE, which is such a tragedy. I mean, it's like the most amazing collection of people, W.H. Auden, Benjamin Britten, Richard Wright, Carson McCullers, Gypsy Rose Lee. I mean, just on and on and on. How did that happen?
That happened because of a friendship between Carson and the Harper's editor, Harper's Bazaar editor, George Davis. They were friends. Carson was new to New York, and her relationship with Reeves was really on the rocks, and he was so controlling. And George Davis was broke and basically kind of needed a roommate. And they found this house in Brooklyn on Mid-Aw Street. I think that's how you pronounce it. And decided, like, okay, if we both live together, you know, in different parts of the house, George Davis was gay, is another kind of note on that. Maybe we can bring other writers and other musicians and choreographers and people in, and people can come and go, but that way we can all afford to live. But, you know, Carson won't be controlled by Reeves. She'll have more freedom, and Davis will be able to afford his somewhat lavish lifestyle. Everyone will be able to afford to eat because we'll, you know, hire a cook for us all. So that is kind of how the idea was born, almost on a whim. And it worked out beautifully. You mentioned a bunch of the different people who lived there at different times. Paul Bowles and Jane Bowles also lived there. And those were some of the friendships that really first solidified Carson's sort of life in New York, her community among creative people, and certainly her queer community. The house got its name from Anais Nin, who realized that most of the people living in the house had been born in February. It was like a very jolly and creative and energetic community of Aquarius sun signs, which to me as an Aquarius sounds really fun.
Yeah. I think Richard Wright moved in with his family and then decided maybe this is not the place for me and my wife and children.
Not a family house. Yeah, I don't think that worked that well. But he ended up allowing Carson to stay in his apartment in Paris a number of times because, you know, they just became really close through that experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned sort of being somewhat jealous of February House, which I think is a very sensible reaction to reading about it and researching it. How did researching McCullers change your life?
Oh, gosh, in so many ways. I mean, at the time when I started, like I said, I was a grad student. I was studying to be a professor, like a literary professor, professor of English. And I am not that. In the process of doing this research, while I was finishing a dissertation on a totally different subject, I just started writing. I started writing about my work in the archive. I started writing about Carson McCullers. And some of my writing started to have some success being published and being was a finalist for a couple of awards at UT that both came with a fair amount of money attached to them. And so I kind of got this idea like, well, maybe this writing thing is actually something that feels like more of a fit to me than the academic work that I've been doing. And I think a lot of that was inspired by studying Carson's life, studying the life of this writer, and understanding kind of how she made that life work. Understanding the other artists and writers that she was in community with and how rich that environment was, I think it made me want that to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So at the end of my grad program, after interviewing for some academic jobs that sounded really, really bleak and not getting them, my partner and I moved to Santa Fe with the intention of just kind of focusing on writing and trying to create some version of that creative life in a place that would allow us to get by on a little bit less than what was required in Austin at the time. Austin was kind of going through this huge tech boom and we were feeling really pushed out. And basically that's kind of worked. I mean, like ever since I have sort of pursued the research into Carson McCullers, wrote the book, got an agent and publisher, and have kind of built my life around writing. And I kind of credit all of that with studying Carson and her life.
Wow. I mean, that's so interesting to me, because in this book, what's very clear is that a part of you loves doing archival research.
Oh, yeah.
So what was it about academia that made you feel like that's not for me after, I mean, you completed your PhD, right?
Yeah, I did.
So you had enough of a taste of that life to know it wasn't for you. What about it seemed like not a good fit?
I think a big part of it has to do with the style of writing, academic writing, which I was capable of doing, but I really couldn't stand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love, as you mentioned, I love doing archival research. I love research in general. Where I'm sitting right now, I'm surrounded by books for the research I'm doing right now. And at the same time, I felt strongly that there was, for me, a different way of writing about that research that made it accessible to more people, that made it accessible beyond sort of the walled off parts of the academic institution. And I wanted people to know this version of Carson McCullers and her life, but I didn't want that to be something that, you know, was discussed within, you know, a small coterie of people, like the 8 people who have read my academic article that I published or whatever. I really wanted it to be part of a larger conversation. At the same time, I really love teaching. And that's something that I miss sometimes. I was adjuncting when I first moved to Santa Fe. But again, I think I am a more natural creative writing professor than I am a literature professor. I find it easier to talk about the writing process than to sort of pick apart the books that have been published. So yeah, I think there were a number of like different political things about being in graduate school, being a graduate student at a big state university, their sort of attitudes toward teaching and funding graduate students and how that was even shifting under our feet in terms of things like health insurance and what we were paid. All those things sort of really turned me off the academy to a large extent. And, you know, I've had a lot of luck outside of it. I actually work now as an archivist for an artist in Santa Fe. That's sort of the work that I do that supports my writing. So in a way, I'm kind of continuing that same process, but just independently.
And I think that's increasingly common, right? That people will get a PhD and then they'll use those skills to do a different related type of work, not necessarily kind of doing the traditional hunt for that tenure track position, right?
Yeah, I think it has to be that way because there are so many PhDs and so few tenure track positions. Right.
Yeah, it's not a choice that they've all decided to make all at the same time.
It isn't. I mean, for me, it felt like a choice and a rejection, but also, you know, because I could have spent the next several years, you know, bopping from fellowship to fellowship and, you know, trying to get that that tenure track dream. But instead, I was like, no, I want to live where I want to live and I want to kind of, you know, figure it out myself. But yeah, I do think that is more common. And I think that there are skills that you get doing a PhD that apply far beyond just academic teaching. At least that's what I've found to be true. Mm-hmm.
One other aspect of the book that I'd love to touch on briefly is chronic illness, which is something that you suffer from and that McCullers also suffered from. And it's something that it seemed like that was another aspect of her life that you felt had been misrepresented in previous attempts to kind of write about her. Could you talk a bit about what your own illness kind of allowed you to see in the archives of McCullers?
Sure. I was kind of in the process of being diagnosed with a chronic illness called POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, basically because I was fainting a lot. And because the illness that I have, some of the main symptoms are exhaustion or fainting and weakness, I was really able to sort of see and read through the lines when Carson is talking about her illness or when others are talking about her behavior. and see someone who is struggling against sort of the limits of their own body. And that's something that I was really feeling strongly about my own body at the time that I was writing, even at the time that I was staying in Carson's house, for example, really feeling those limitations. In terms of her illness being misunderstood, I think, you know, she definitely drank heavily for much of her life, and that's well documented. And I think her own illness and the various ways in which she suffered, especially after her first stroke, were just not very well understood by people, by doctors at the time. She was misdiagnosed a number of times. And a lot of people, Truman Capote being one of them, really like to just say, oh, I think she's kind of like hamming it up to get attention, or I think she's faking it, or she's just a drunk. You know, like the things that people would say about her were pretty harsh, and were really, you know, failures, I think, to understand what was going on and what she was experiencing physically and sort of the limitations of her body. And then I think that is the kind of points to some larger issues around the way women's health in general has been kind of like understood by the medical establishment, which is something else I've sort of written a bit about. And definitely something that Carson was up against, where doctors would kind of maybe suggest that the stroke was actually just because she was emotionally upset, you know, and things like that. And so like then her like partial paralysis of her body was somehow psychosomatic. Like, it just makes no sense. But it's also really common in the way that women's illnesses have been treated throughout history and still to this day.
Yeah. And yeah, that's not really a thing. People don't just make up illnesses to get attention. There are much easier and more effective ways to get attention than that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is a very small detail in your book, but I wanted to ask you about it. You write that you wrote your master's thesis on David Foster Wallace, who's about as different a writer from McCullers as I can imagine. Was there a connection between these two writers in your mind at all? Or was it more like, well, I'm done with that. Let me do something completely different.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the connection for sure is the Harry Ransom Center. And I was... one of the reasons I got that internship was because I wanted to research in the Wallace archive and collection. And a lot of the kind of first months of my internship, I spent just standing in front of the shelves of his personal library, which the Ransom Center has, and kind of just picking books off the shelf, off his shelf, and kind of looking at his annotations, understanding what he was reading. But I think there is certainly a connection between the two writers for me, because of the way they write about place. So my work on Wallace at the time was focused on his version of the Midwest. And I was looking at his drafts of his last book, The Pale King, and sort of its depiction of Peoria and of rural Illinois. And Carson, of course, is writing about the South and writing about small towns in the South, a very different place. But I think that the way both writers understand how place affects your psyche, I think those are like two big overlaps between them. And then I think they both also have that sense of humor, but also sense of, you know, the true darkness of life, of existence. So yeah, I think there's kind of a lot of weird overlaps there, but I don't know if anyone else would see that but me, because I was kind of so immersed in both of their works at different times in my life.
And finally, you've mentioned that you have books around you right now that are related to your next project. Are you far enough along in that project that you'd be comfortable telling us a bit about what that is?
Sure. Yeah, I'm working on two very different things right now. One is a collection of essays that are based in New Mexico and that kind of deal with a range of subjects from wellness and healing to toxicity and kind of the nuclear history of the Manhattan Project and the Trinity Test in New Mexico, to kind of more like broad essays about materialism and consumer culture. The last one's about my kind of decision not to get married and not to have kids. So they range over a number of topics centered kind of in my life in New Mexico. And the other project is a novel that I started during the lockdown in the spring. So it may never go anywhere, but we'll see. I never thought of myself as a fiction writer, but this was kind of the thing that I was able to wrap my mind around when my research seemed a little bit difficult or distant or hard to kind of grasp. So I started this other project. It's kind of maybe auto fiction. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
This present book is not auto fiction. It definitely has some of that DNA in it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that with the McCullers project, I wanted to see sort of how using just actual, you know, factual information, you know, how far can you tweak that form? How far can you take nonfiction? And so now I think I'm starting to think about it from the other direction. How much of the real world, how much of your life can you put into something and then call it fiction? So we'll see how that all works out.
Well, I'm excited to read those whenever they do come out. Jen Chaplin, thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts. I really enjoyed my autobiography of Carson McCullers. I can't speak highly enough of it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me. Really, really nice to chat with you.